Greetings and welcome to another episode of ACS Law Talk, a legal podcast presented by the American Constitution Society. I'm Joseph Jerome, and I'll be hosting this episode. Affirmative action continues to be a volatile issue in this country, and this week the Supreme Court finds that issue front and center in the case of Fisher v. University of Texas. This case could dramatically alter how college admissions officers consider students' race. In many ways, the case is a replay of an earlier decision, Grutter v. Bollinger, a 2003 decision, where the Supreme Court upheld highly individualized, holistic review of college applicants where race was considered in order to achieve classroom diversity. In response to that case, the University of Texas implemented a similar sort of review for applicants who are not admitted under the top 10% plan, which automatically lets in students at the top of their high school classes. The minority of students who aren't admitted this way get this individualized, holistic review that where race is considered. Abigail Fisher has sued, arguing that this plan violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And now, not a decade removed from Grutter, the Supreme Court again has the opportunity to decide whether admissions departments can consider race in the college admissions process. To figure out why the court has again decided to get involved with this hot-button issue, and to discuss what it should do now that it has, I'll be speaking to Professor Ted Shaw and Thomas Sines of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. But first up is Ted Shaw. Professor Shaw is a law professor at Columbia Law School. He spent more than two decades with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and he now sits on the board of ACS. So, Professor Shaw, my first question is, Senator Day O'Connor suggested that using race in admissions would be something worth reconsidering in 25 years'
25
time.
25 years, right. Yep.
Yet here we are. Hasn't been a decade yet. So why did the Supreme Court decide to grant cert in this case?
The proper answer is we don't know. I think the real answer is closer to something like there's been a change in the personnel of the court. You know, I can't feel sanguine about what the possible outcome of this case is and whether or not the Michigan case, the Grutter case, is going to survive.
This case is a direct descendant of the Michigan case, and Texas's plan was pretty much crafted in response to that decision, and neither the Michigan law schools or Texas's plan is really traditional affirmative action as it was once understood. It's much more diversity centric. So I guess I was just wondering if you could sort of discuss the Texas plan.
Yeah, well, as you know, what makes Fisher different than Grutter is the fact that this is Grutter diversity overlaid upon the 10% plan that Texas adopted after the Hopwood decision, which declared diversity efforts, race-conscious diversity efforts, to be unconstitutional before Grutter was decided. In fact, the Hopwood court said not only was Texas's admissions plan at the law school unconstitutional, the one that was in effect at the time, but also that Bakke wasn't good law. And I mention that because you have a court, or at least some judges on the court of the Fifth Circuit, who have been hostile to diversity efforts for a long time. But the overlay of Grutter diversity on top of the 10% plan makes the Fisher case different because the plaintiff argues that the 10% plan provides all or produces all the diversity that the University of Texas needs, and that the overlay of Grutter diversity on top of the 10% plan is not only superfluous in its effect, but also reflects a kind of a slavishness to race-conscious measures. That's the argument that the plaintiff makes. The University of Texas, of course, makes the argument that that it is under Grutter free to use race as one factor among many as long as it isn't weighted too heavily, as long as there aren't quotas, as long as there are, you know, it's individualized review, holistic review, one pool of applicants, et cetera, to produce diversity. And even after the 10% plan, there are still large numbers of classes at the University of Texas that don't have any African Americans or Latinos, and they want to be able to do something to try to produce more diversity in those classes. So you know, it's the case presents a wrinkle that didn't exist in Michigan when one looks at the 10% plan and the question of whether or not that produces enough student body diversity, which the plaintiffs here say that's what Grutter was about. It's not about classroom level diversity. And there are other arguments, of course, that are being made. The plaintiffs have suggested that Grutter be revisited, although I think it's pretty clear that the court need not revisit Grutter. But they didn't take this case, I think, to let Grutter stand.
Now, if I understand Abigail Fisher's argument, because Texas and UT have such a long history of racial discrimination, that the school's admissions process should be entirely race blind. I was wondering, do you think the court should take both Texas and UT's long history of discrimination into account when looking at this case?
Well, you're touching on something that is one of the things that I, as a general matter, talk about most, although I feel sometimes that on this issue I'm a mad dog howling in the wind. And, you know, I want to be clear so that's not taken out of context what I mean by that. In order to understand what I'm talking about, one has to go back to the Bakke decision.
Okay.
Bakke was a case that was decided by the court in 1978. And I think of that as being about 10 years, a decade, after really the end of the era of Jim Crow segregation. I say that because Brown was decided in 1954, but that didn't mean that the era of Jim Crow ended on the day that Brown was decided on May 17, 1954. You know, school desegregation took another 15 to 20 years to be accomplished in many parts of the South. In some places, it never was. You know, the 64 Civil Rights Act was passed that outlawed employment discrimination, discrimination in public accommodations, discrimination in federally funded programs. But again, that was enacted in 64 and it wasn't enforced until after that. And so right on up through the middle of the 1960s, there was still legally sanctioned or at least legally untouched employment discrimination and public accommodations and federally funded programs. It took until 1965 for the Voting Rights Act to be enacted. It took until 67 for the Supreme Court to strike down bans on interracial marriages. It took until 68 to have the Fair Housing Act passed in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination. And it was right after Martin Luther King was assassinated that higher educational institutions really began to admit African Americans and then Latinos in significant numbers. And when they did it, they didn't do it because they woke up one day and said, you know what, we've been missing something. Diversity is good. This is about diversity. They were trying to address the effects of our long history of slavery and Jim Crow segregation and denial of opportunity. That's why they got into efforts to admit students of color. Bakke, on the day that it was decided, was a devastating loss in the minds of many African Americans. I was at the Supreme Court the day that Bakke was announced. I heard the parts of the opinions read from the bench, and I left the courthouse devastated. Why? Because the court rejected the arguments of African Americans that that the 14th Amendment had particular meaning for African Americans. You know, there's no question it applied to everybody. But if you look at the history of the 14th Amendment, there's no doubt that it applied with special force to African Americans. And as a consequence, what was argued there by organizations representing the interests of African Americans, including the NAACP with LaFence Fund, was that there should be a different standard applied to race-conscious measures that were employed to overcome this history of discrimination or the effects of the history of discrimination on the one hand, and race-conscious measures that were rooted in notions of superiority and inferiority, in other words, invidious discrimination. The court rejected that that argument. The court also created a category of discrimination that it called societal discrimination, end quotes. Societal discrimination, in short, is discrimination for which nobody's responsible and for which there's no remedy. So the court said that the University of California at Berkeley couldn't try to admit students of color to overcome the dearth of black physicians and Latino physicians and minority physicians and the discrimination that had occurred that impacted the number of minority doctors, that institutions could only remedy their own specific discrimination, but they can't remedy discrimination of others. That was a judicial or jurisprudential policy choice that wasn't necessary, but that's where the court went. And over the years, the court proceeded to shove more and more discrimination into the category of societal discrimination. And, you know, the court wrings its hands about it, but then washes its hands of it. So it leaves the huge body of structural discrimination and inequality intact, if that makes sense.
No, I think that makes perfect sense, but it does present the bigger question, the bigger, more perspective question about how does our society go about addressing systemic discrimination?
Well, yeah. Well, let me go back to something else that Bakke did for a moment. That's hugely important because it has impact even as we look to the Fisher argument next week. The other thing that the court did was, in effect, marginalize or exclude the voices of African Americans and people of color from subsequent cases involving these issues, or at least largely excluded them. What do I mean by that? I don't think the court did that intentionally, but that's the impact. Justice Powell's opinion is grounded in the First Amendment interest of the university and academic freedom. And, you know, to the extent that it allows the institution to pursue racial diversity, which results in the admission of students of color, it's because of the educational benefit that their presence is going to have to other students, in other words, white students. To be more generous, one could say that it's the educational benefit that all students experience from being in a diverse environment. But, originally it really was about the educational experience of the students who were there and the benefits of bringing in these minority students. There's something that I'm not saying there's no value to that or there's no credibility to it, but in a sense, it's an inability of the court, a reflected inability of the court, or at least Justice Powell, to ground what was called affirmative action, or now it's called diversity efforts, in the interests, particularly the 14th Amendment equal protection interest and the remedial imperative of students of color and their access to higher educational institutions. Why is that significant in the cases that are being litigated now and in the Michigan cases and in the Parents Involved case a few years ago with respect to the issue of whether voluntary school integration was illegal or unconstitutional? Well, you get these so-called reverse discrimination cases in which white plaintiffs sue institutions, and those are the parties. And unless black and Latino students or students of color can intervene, which they have to scratch and claw to do, they don't have a voice. And even if they intervene so far at the Supreme Court level, there has been no voice for them in oral argument, for example. And so even though they are the ones who are going to be impacted the most, they are left marginalized and voiceless by the structure of the cases that come to the court.
All right. Well, prediction time. How is the Supreme Court going to come down in Fisher?
Well, you know, when one has been before the Supreme Court for a long time or watched the Supreme Court, I think one learns that it's a mistake to predict what the court is going to do. You know, a lot of people say that that anything could happen. Anything could happen here. You know, if Justice Kennedy were to fall back on stare decisis as he did in Roe versus Wade, not Roe versus Wade, rather the Casey case back in the early 90s, then the university could prevail.
Also, there's another wrinkle here in the sense that Justice Kagan's recused, and Kennedy's obviously the swing vote here. So if you get a 4-4 split, you know, what happens?
You get, well, if you get a 4-4 split, you get an affirmance without an opinion of the court below, of the Fifth Circuit. So that's a win for the University of Texas. So in a sense, Justice Kagan's recusal doesn't really matter. You'd have to get Kennedy anyway. The only thing that changes is whatever impact Justice Kagan's voice could have had in writing opinions. Maybe she would have persuaded somebody. Maybe she wouldn't have. Who knows? The question is whether or not you get Justice Kennedy. Here's the thing about Justice Kennedy, and it requires an observation about Justice O'Connor. People remember Justice O'Connor as a liberal. Many now remember her as a liberal because of her vote in Grutter, in the Michigan law school case. She was no liberal on race issues. Hers was a voice that, or vote rather, that we who litigated civil rights cases did not get in just about every civil rights case involving race that came before her. The point is this, you know, she was persuaded largely, a lot of people believe, and I'm one of them, by the briefs filed by retired military officials and you know, 65 corporations in Grutter. I think that moved her more than the voices of students of color, you know, as amicus in the Grutter case. But in any event, she did vote that way, and I'm eternally grateful. Justice Kennedy has voted to strike down every race-conscious measure that has come before him. Even in parents involved a few years ago, while fortunately he did not go as far as Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas and Alito and Scalia would have gone in making all race-conscious measures unconstitutional outside of the remedial context, and there's very little left of the remedial context, if anything. But Justice Kennedy wouldn't go that far, yet he struck down what was before him. What I think is a likely outcome here is that he will probably vote to strike down what's before him, as he had everything else that he's seen that's race conscious, but he will not join, he will resist joining the other four and say that all race-conscious measures are unconstitutional. And so it'll be backing away from Grutter. It will gut Grutter to some degree. But theoretically, it'll leave something, you know, alive. And that is, I think, a very possible outcome in this case. And so I'm not sanguine about the outcome here. You know, I'm not happy they took this case, although, you know, in my fondest dreams, I hope that Justice Kennedy will say stare decisis, that he will, or he'll feel like it's one thing to be in dissent in the Grutter case. It's another thing to be the swing vote, to walk over to the edge of the precipice, peer over, and think about whether we take the nation down into that abyss, in which we turn around the clock in terms of opportunities for students of color at selective institutions. You know, and maybe he'll say, I don't want to go there. But that's hope.
Well, I don't want to end my conversation with you on such a down note. So let me ask you to look prospectively. we're facing increasingly segregated primary and secondary schools in our country. Grutter could be gutted here, as you say. So how do we go about ensuring that minorities have greater access to higher education and more opportunities in our society?
Yeah, well, the court has already said that voluntary integration methods, when you talk about elementary and secondary school, are largely unconstitutional. I mean, theoretically, there's something still left there, but you know, it has made it very difficult to pursue those ends. And so then the question is whether or not we're able to effectuate positive change in elementary schools that are both racially and economically segregated and isolated when we can't be conscious about doing anything about racial segregation in those schools, because in the Orwellian view of a majority of the court, that represents discrimination against white students, presumably. Or, you know, are there, you know, completely race-neutral ways to reach the education that is experienced by these students in spite of the fact that they are in racially segregated schools? Well, there probably are some things and many things that can be done to improve education in schools that are racially and economically isolated. We can put more money into these schools, although there's limited appetite for doing that, and that's a political matter. A lot of people have made the unwise judgment that they don't have a great interest in doing it, that they don't have a lot at stake, even though they do. You know, we can talk about a right to quality education. All those things are important. They are not substitutes for students experiencing going to school together, learning to work and live together in a diverse country and world, experiencing diversity. There's no substitute for that. You know, I think we can try to, and we have to try to continue to work to improve the quality of education. But there are some important things that have been taken out of our hands or are being taken out of our hands by the Supreme Court. At the end of the day, my biggest hope is that what the court says, to the extent that this is a regressive court on these kinds of issues, doesn't have a lasting impact, because the demographic changes of the country and the change in heart of the country, the way people think about these issues differently, will mean that people will find a way to address these issues, that we simply won't sit for you know, the inequality that that characterizes a lot of our public school education. Again, that's a hope too, because we're a country that's becoming more economically segregated, and racial segregation remains a reality, an abiding reality in public education, and we've gone backward. You know, hope is a choice. You know, it's not something that just happens serendipitously, and you know, you got to keep fighting. You have no choice. You know, when I say all the time that you know, if you fight, you may win and you may lose, but if you don't fight, you can't win. And so we have no choice. We have to keep fighting, even when we have a court that seems poised to do great damage.
I also got to speak briefly with Thomas Sines. Mr. Sines is the president and general counsel of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, MALDEF. And on behalf of a number of Hispanic American organizations, he wrote an amicus brief in the case, and he's been very involved in the litigation. So my first question is about the amicus brief that MALDEF signed on to. The brief emphasizes the continuing institutional barriers that are present in Texas today that affect Latinos. I think this is actually a really important point in this case, because in Texas, racial discrimination continues to be a very real phenomenon. Do you think the Supreme Court will take this reality into account?
Well, I certainly hope that the amicus brief that MALDEF drafted on behalf of nearly two dozen Latino organizations receives some attention from the court so that they understand the context. Now, regrettably, the Supreme Court long ago concluded that diversity is the only available compelling government interest to support an admissions program like this. They no longer take into account formally the need to remedy continuing effects of discrimination in an education program. Nonetheless, I do think it's critical content. And indeed, in Texas, as you've noted, there is a regrettably very long and continuing history of unequal educational opportunity from kindergarten through 12th grade. Indeed, MALDEF is about to commence a trial in a few weeks in yet another challenge to the Texas school financing scheme, which continues to result in dramatic differences based on the property wealth of a district, so that wealthier districts have more money at their disposal to spend on education, and as a result, the educational experience is going to be enhanced in those districts. It's also no surprise that these distinctions based on district property wealth also correspond to the race of the students who are enrolled. If you are an African-American or Latino, you're far more likely to be in one of the property poor districts. So there are still continuing challenges in Texas around equal educational opportunity, and those certainly play some role in the need for the University of Texas to have an equal opportunity admissions program like the one that it has.
Well, I mean, I was wondering if, just as an aside, if whether you could elaborate on that a bit more, because I mean, I think part of the problem is obviously we have increasingly segregated primary and secondary schools. So how do we ensure opportunity for Latinos and other minority students earlier on in the process, in their educational process?
Well, it's an ongoing challenge. It's certainly something that our nation needs to face up to and really put some serious attention to resolving. We know that these sorts of inequities exist across the country. We know that they correspond to both race and class. And we know that we have some very tough solutions that we have to make the decision to put in place. This really is the singular educational issue that we face today, given the growth of the Latino population in particular, particularly in the younger cohort. They are the future of this country. And if we don't put more effort into addressing the issue of the achievement gap and the issues of inequality and opportunity that go with it, our country is going to face some serious challenges in the future. Now, of course, that can't happen at the expense of continuing to permit universities to have equal opportunity admissions programs. Both need to happen at the same time. We need to attend to fixing some of the inequalities, as many of them as possible, in kindergarten to 12th grade education, while we allow universities to take into account all elements in putting together the most well-qualified student body that they can.
All right. Now, if I can play devil's advocate here for a second.
Sure.
Now, I've heard that the use of race in the UT admissions process pretty much boils down to being a factor of a factor. You know, it's one of 17 different factors that are considered in applicants.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I just want to ask, if the consideration of race is so marginalized at this point, why does it remain an important factor?
Well, the University of Texas program was initially devised following the Michigan decisions to supplement the top 10% plan that still determines the vast majority, 80% or so, of admissions to the university. The top 10% plan basically admits students based on their performance in their own high school. The reason that that top 10% plan yields some diversity, though certainly not matching the diversity of the population, but yields significant diversity, is because of the continued, in part because of the continued segregation that applies in kindergarten through 12th grade in Texas. And University of Texas knew that that segregation still was a widespread phenomenon, and therefore believed, with good reason, that the top 10% plan would yield a significant diversity. And it has. But it has not remotely matched the population of Texas, first of all, nor has it resulted in diversity in each of the different majors that the university provide. And that, I think, is why they chose, once permitted to do so under the Michigan cases, to supplement the top 10% plan for that remaining small portion of the class with a whole person evaluation. And in that whole person evaluation, as you've indicated, one subfactor of one subfactor is a consideration of race. So it really is a program that is narrowly tailored Indeed, it's hard to imagine a more narrowly tailored program than the University of Texas program, which also explains why it is a bit of a surprise that the Supreme Court has taken up this particular challenge.
Do you think there's any sort of way to get to a class neutral program or a class neutral program that also, you know, achieves the sort of requisite diversity we're looking for?
I think in the current circumstances in Texas and throughout the country, it would be extraordinarily difficult to get to the level of diversity that our nation needs for its future without taking into account the fact that we have unequal educational opportunity in kindergarten through 12th grade. And therefore, if you want to truly evaluate who has done the best given what was available to them, in some cases you have to take into consideration race. That's the reality of our continued inability to ensure equal educational opportunity in high school and before. As long as we continue to struggle with those issues, it's hard to imagine a university being able to pick the best applicants while taking into account all of the relevant context and circumstances without at least considering race in certain circumstances. And that's precisely what the University of Texas program allows.
Do you want to make a prediction about how the Supreme Court's going to come down here?
I do not. I think that it will be interesting to see how it works. I think that the last couple of years, even last term, has demonstrated the folly of predicting too easily what the outcomes are likely to be. I do hope that the justices take into account all of the relevant context, even those that may not strictly be a part of the constitutional test that has been established to date. And I believe that if they take into account all of that context, that there is a good chance that a majority of the justices will conclude that we are not yet at the point in this country's history where we have succeeded enough at ensuring equal opportunity that we can dispense with programs like the University of Texas program.
As always, theme music is Brass Beat by Covert, which is available to download on a Creative Commons license. For everyone at ACS, I hope you enjoyed the podcast.